I think that answers it.
Oh, yeah. More than I had even dreamed that you would. Just about every answer you've given me has been more than I hoped for, which is good. I'll have plenty of fun editing this stuff down. There's so much material that we could make the whole issue about you, Dirk. I don't think we could sell them on it, though, unfortunately.
It would sell like hotcakes, not like magazines.
If they had one on Jimi Hendrix, they should have one on. Unfortunately, you have to die before they would do that.
I don't know whether it was guitar player or not, but Tommy had an interview in a magazine about 3 months ago, and I still haven't finished it. It's half the magazine.
Who was it?
Tommy Tedesco.
Oh, yeah.
You know the article I mean?
I just saw one in guitar.
Was it frets or keyboard?
I just saw one in Guitar Player from last year.
Or Guitar. You know the other magazine?
Guitar World? Was Tommy Tedesco in there? I haven't.
It was one of those magazines. I still haven't finished it. I haven't got the magazine. But I started reading part of it at a show last year. And then Bob Miro had one at the house, so I read a little more of the article. But it goes on page after page. It's very interesting.
That's what's yours.
Well, Tommy's funny, you know.
He is a funny.
It goes on page after page. So I have to find another friend that's got the magazine so I can finish it. I've read about two-thirds of it.
That's Guitar Player. Is it
Guitar Player?
Yeah, that was the issue.
Yeah, there are a lot of pictures of Tommy.
He is a character.
Oh, he is.
That column of his every month is pretty funny.
He was at the show again this year. Wearing that little black hat and cap.
Playing so that you can't see his right hand move, but you hear a thousand.
He didn't play. he didn't. Or did he?
Yeah.
He did play? I didn't get the hand.
Plays a million notes, and you don't even see his hand move.
I know. Yeah, I've worked a lot with Tommy. Tommy and I opened the first guitar night at Donnie's.
I was going to ask you about that. I might as well ask you now.
Jack Marshall started that.
Yeah. What was that a wonderful experience, or was that a pressure experience?
I'll tell you, we were both scared to death. We didn't know what we were getting into. We weren't supposed to start playing until 9 o'clock, and Tommy got there at 8, and so did I. And we weren't playing together. You know, it wasn't
too sure.
It was Frank Flynn and I. We were one group, and Tommy had bass and drums. Tommy was so nervous. I mean, of course, this was, you know, this is what, 1966. And Tommy wasn't as fearless then as he is now. He's a marvelous player. But he was so worried because he'd never done anything like that before. And Frank and I had worked together for 6 years on a Kurt Massey show. So we had some things that we had some skeletons. Well, we really didn't know what we were going to do. You know. But we had some basic formats, you know. We didn't know what key we were going to play the tune in, but we knew we'd meet in certain places, you know.
Somebody after two choruses or something like that, someone would.
It would start to gel, yeah, and then we'd get something going and make the hodgepodge that started come together at the end a little bit, you know, by shoehorning and then squeezing and everything and try to make sense out of it. But Tommy was so nervous. And he played beautifully. Oh, he gassed everybody because he played some of those things that go so fast. Like Ted said, you've seen him play. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I use that term meaningfully because Tommy's he's fun to watch because he, like you said, he hardly moves his right hand
or anything. He's just just up there.
Well, yeah, right.
But there's got to be something going on.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, his computer is going 9 miles an hour. 90 miles. But
he's going to, by the way, contribute some comments to this article. I was talking to him. Oh, yeah. I'm going to get some comments from a lot of people if we can.
Well, he'll remember that opening night at Donnie's. Jack Marshall talked us into it. Well, first of all, he talked Cary Leverett. And Sonny and Bill were associated with the place. I don't remember that last name. Jack gave Cary the business. The place was dying. Somehow Jack Marshall sold Cary Leverett the idea of having Guitar Monday night. So we did. Tommy and I did the first one, and I was scared, and so was Tommy. We got through it all, I think.
This is all the material I knew through the years. Sonny, let's see what they say. Sonny McKay, Bill and Sonny McKay.
Yeah, that's it. Yes.
They've got.
Yeah.
Downbeat caught you that night. A number of people. Yeah. The Caught in the Act routine that used to be in Downbeat.
Oh, I have never seen it.
No?
No.
I'll have to make you a copy. So I'll use.
Leonard Feather was there, I believe.
Before I leave, you can ask me about the ones
Leonard
you don't have.
Leonard gave us a nice write up.
But that was.
Very complimentary.
When you played, it was a packed house and the whole bit. Was it a real pressure scene, or did you love doing it? Or?
Oh, I loved it.
I mean, it seems like that was a standout night that everyone who was there remembers.
Yeah, it was only the first night that was scary because Frank had never done anything like that before, Frank Flynn, and I hadn't either. I played lots of solo things, you know, for. Guitar groups and things like that, you know, but not in a nightclub atmosphere, you know, with bands, or with 4 or 5 men.
So that was one of the first major showcases.
Tommy and I looked at the marquee on the way in, and it says Van Epps and Tedesco, and of course Tedesco and Van Epps. Anyway, there are names and our last names in big letters like this one. And that's what made us nervous, I think, because the people are going to pay money to come in and listen, you know. Oh, gee. Nobody to lean on, you know. You go to the woods, you do it all by yourself. Yeah.
Luckily, though, you always know how to get out of the woods. Not that I hear you going there, but I just know from your comments there would never be an extended series of being there.
Well,
you certainly pull right
like out. We were talking about earlier, Ted, about... playing safe on certain things and playing things that you've done before that you know are going to work. And so if the going gets too rough, why then it's time to look down in a bag of tricks and see what you can come up with, you know, to bail out a bad situation. And there were a few spots that night. We did 3 or 4 sets, 1-hour sets, and the evening worked out very well. So the ice was broken, and the next week when Tommy didn't do it the following week, but Frank and I did it the following week, and a couple of evenings that week, we got together and laid out some skeleton arrangements on things so that we'd have it left us lots of freedom, but we had more definite meeting places.
Maybe, you know, a few endings worked out that would sound real, you would come back together for the end.
Yeah, sure, yeah. And we'd have some intros and codas worked out. You know?
Yeah, I hear that on that album, the first album you guys did together, and that's one of the most charming aspects of it, is that there's all this freedom in the middle, and then it's like they tag on lollipops and roses.
Each take was different. Those are just skeletons, but we had the skeleton laid down. We had the introductions and the codas ironed out, and a few meeting places in the middle, and where there was a firstly, secondly, and thirdly, fourthly choice in a certain place in a bridge or whatever. I'd ask Frank what he preferred under his solo, and he would say, well, now we get him back. He said, well, I would prefer the C minor 6 with him bringing the F 7 and so forth. And so I would abide by that. I would honor that so it wouldn't throw him a curve. I wouldn't start to do a dance with the voices, you know, and get in his way because it would spoil what he had in his mind.
Yeah, I've got the accompaniment part to one of his solos transcribed there. It was nice. It was as nice as...
Oh, do you?
Yeah. It's...
Oh, yeah. Hey, while we're talking, Ed... Ted brought these, and the notes are so small, I'd have to
I wasn't, you know, when I was doing it, George, I wasn't thinking that I would ever give it out.
I told Ed on the phone that you were doing that.
But I was having so much fun, I just wanted to learn about it, and I did get a 7-string, so I was able to...
Marvelous. And like I said before, Ted, I'm sure that Mel would go for that.
That'd be wonderful. That'd be a good use of my time.
Well, and who knows? It might be a source of revenue, you know.
Not a bad idea.
We can't tell. They might sell. Because, after all, there are quite a few 7-string guitars out now.
It's getting better, huh? I wanted to ask...
Well, Gretsch sold over 500, so we know there's that many.
Are they going to produce it again? Or are they
currently... Well, we're negotiating with two companies. One is... Ed will remember this better than I do. One company is... Is it Ibanez?
Yes.
Ibanez. And what was the other one, Ed?
Aria? Is it a company akin to that?
No, it's a Japanese company.
Okay.
No, it isn't. I take it back. Oh. Ibanez is Japanese.
Right.
Jimmy DiCristo.
Oh. Production, huh? To do it in a production
yeah.
basis?
Yeah. In fact, he's making one now for my approval.
He's quite a
He made one for the fellow that writes, Howie Morgan, that writes in guitar. And I played Howie's guitar just for a little bit last year, last June in Chicago. And it was beautiful. But the thing that threw me a curve, they threw it at me. I walked down to where Howard was playing. He got up and handed me the guitar. And there's a crowd of people around, you know.
As if they wanted to perform that.
And it's an ultra, ultra cutaway. In other words, the 14th fret, or rather the 12th...
The 12th fret is what?
Yeah, the 12th fret is nowhere near the beginning of the body. It's a very small body. But, if I hadn't looked, there's where I made my mistake. If I closed my eyes, I wouldn't have had any trouble. But quite a few places I overshot it terribly because there was no body there. You get used to having your hand hit the heel.
That makes sense.
You know, and the heel was not at the 14th fret. It was way gone. It was 6 inches away from there.
That's interesting.
So instead of jumping a ninth, I jump almost 2 octaves.
So the prospects look at least reasonably hopeful that someone's going to produce one again?
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
I would, monetarily speaking, everybody says that if Ibanez makes it, it'd be a better deal because they manufacture 100 times over Jimmy. You know.
They know what they're doing, apparently, from their
work.
Yeah,
their workmanship look pretty good.
Been,
in fact, I've got the templates are in that tube and a drawing of the neck that has to go in the mail to Japan.
I might as well segue to the equipment. I'll come back to this since we're on it. I do want to speed this up, so I don't keep you guys all day. Let's see.
Dead, I told you, don't worry about that.
I know, but George,
I'm just thinking, how's your tape holding?
Well, so far so good, and I've got two. I brought enough thinking that maybe one of them would break in each machine, which they wouldn't, but it just didn't, you know.
That's all right.
I never dreamed I'd be using all this tape, but it's wonderful.
What is that principle? Whatever can go wrong, probably wrong, or something like that.
Yeah, I generally don't believe in that, but I just plan, just in case, you know?
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, that's good.
Let's see. Where is that? Come on, Ted. Be organized now.
Can you see that, Ed?
Why did you go to the Epiphone company instead of someone else to build the guitar? Were they the most esteemed in your mind at the time, the most qualified or capable?
I was. I got to know Epi very well. Epistophilos Stathopoulos. And he was a marvelous man and very, very open-minded. And I had experimented for a year and a half with this seven concept. By taking one of my six-string guitars and eliminating the top E string,
right.
And just stringing it with the second six-string tuning, to find out its feasibility and practicality as far as notation is concerned, and I didn't want to make the seven-string a roving bass string that you tune to whatever key you're playing in, because if you're in all keys, you need something locked.
Yes.
If you're going to think in all keys, you need something locked. So, after about 6 months or so of this experimentation, I had lunch with that Epi down on 14th Street, and I told him about the idea, and he listened very intently. He didn't interrupt me, and he said, "That sounds marvelous." I expected a different answer than that. I was flabbergasted. I really didn't know what to say next. So I said, "Well, Epi, can we build one?" And he said, "I don't see why not." And of course, I had in the back of my mind the fact that Epi had working for him one of the finest neck makers in the world. He's an old fellow, 65 years old. What he didn't know about carving a neck wasn't worth knowing. And so we went back upstairs into the factory and talked to this old gentleman. I've forgotten his name. And we laid out the dimensions. And Epi, a very intelligent man, he said, now with this low A-string, he said, it's going to vibrate much wider than the rest. The arc is going to be larger.
Why would that be?
The heavier weight.
Okay.
Weight mass, inertia, that's what gives the strings a tonality. It's their pitch, rather. Because for a string to be right, a normal weight string is under 23 pounds tension. And when the string makers make a string, like D'Addario, he's the best string maker around now. They have the 25 and a half inch string length. And they have the anchor up here, they have a bridge here and a bridge here. This bridge has a ball bearing roller on it. And they hang a 23 pound weight on it. If that string doesn't sound the note it's supposed to sound, because there's the gap from the bridge to the nut on the guitar. And at 23 pounds, if it's an E string, it's got to sound an E. So, all right.
That's for a 13 gauge E?
It's 2/10 over 13. Yeah. All right. Now, I'm not just rambling on with this, but the weight mass inertia, each string as you go down is 23 pounds, but what makes the B string sound a B is that there's more weight mass. It vibrates.
Can't get it.
It vibrates slower. See? All right. You notice, you pick the E string, then the B string, then the G string, and the arc vibrating from side to side. There go, the string's going like this, you know. And as you go down, you get down to the E string, and now it's very wide. And now you get to the A string, and it's wider. All right. Now, if the seventh string is the equidistant to all the others, why, you can't get your finger in between without having it buzz against your finger. If the seventh string has to sing, and it's too close to the E string, well, it's going to buzz it either against your fingernail or the pad of your finger. And it'll stop, of course. So it has to be moved over just a little bit. So the theorem is this, and I'm not good at... there's the mathematician right there. But you don't... I mean, spacing strings, the correct way to do it, you don't go center to center. You go periphery to periphery, outside dimension. Yeah, and that gives the automatic spacing, because that's the difference in the arc.
So you can put your fingers in.
So actually, it's geometric progression. They move over a little bit. But it's just barely noticeable. Yeah,
never knew that before.
Yeah. Well, if you took a quarter-inch gauge and set the top E string... Now you've got to file a notch for the B string. Put the quarter inch gauge in there and file it. Then when the B string's in, put the quarter inch gauge in there, file the slot for the G string. When that G string is in, file a notch for the D string. And there's your outside to outside dimension, not center of the string to center of the string. Because if you put the quarter centers all the way across, when you got down to the E and A string, well, you got a tiny gap between them because it's so fat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's don't use quarter inch as a dimension. I just use that because
it's
a round figure. Yeah, it's not that wide.
So you went to Epiphone, and they basically because of the neck maker, and you knew this.
I knew I wouldn't get an argument.
I
figured I'll get less of an argument from Epi because at that time, Ted. Guitar, not only in the way it was being played, but the way it was being manufactured, the way it was being built, was traditional. We don't change, it's been done this way for hundreds of years, and that's the way it's going to be done. You know, one of those things. Closed mind, not Epi. And so 6 months later, I got the delivery of the first seven string, and it was a fair. It was a good instrument, but it was very green. The fingerboard was beautiful. Oh, the neck was marvelous. So, I played that with. I was with Adrian Lena's trio at the time. I played that thing for about 3 months, and the moment of decision was here. Now, after 3 months, it had arrived. I took my marvelous deluxe six-string down to the Epiphone factory. They sawed the neck off it, re-notched it, and slipped the set. Slipped an identical neck.
So you had two early ones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because during that three-month period while I was testing it, the old man was making another neck. That moment of decision, you know, is the instrument going to be any good? Because it was a marvelous body. Marvelous. Balanced register. The treble, it wasn't boomy in the bass, and it wasn't tinny upstairs. And good timber all the way through.
And that's the one you still have?
Yeah.
That's my favorite. That's your favorite?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
The production ones don't have as good a sound, huh?
No, they don't.
It's because of the lack of the acoustic property, would you say? Yeah, like because they're all the hardware on there and not the spruce wood and such?
Well, Ted, this the old theory that you can stretch a string across a 2x4 and put an on-bodied pickup under it and get the same tone from a guitar is not really true for this reason. That a good acoustic instrument, to begin with a proper pickup that isn't going to mute it in any way or stymie the tone, there is a feedback, even though the tone is coming directly from the string. We know that. It's going directly into the magnetic field.
Right.
You can take a paper clip and put it over the pickup and you can hear what's going on. But The string is vibrating. It's going through the pickup. Now, the pickup, the sound is also going through the bridge and coming back and feeding back through the pickup. So you've got a loop going. So if it's a slab, you don't have that loop.
Now the Gretsch is
because the deck isn't singing.
Right. Yeah. Deck. Yes.
Right.
The Gretsch has that big tuning. I never did understand what that tuning fork apparatus was for. On
Do you have one with a tuning fork?
No, I just saw one once that had that.
Oh, the best thing to do with that is to take it out and go fishing. Use it for a sinker.
Yeah, I turned down.
That's terrible.
What was that supposed to do? Add sustain?
Oh, that because somebody Gretsch. There's a fork out of one of them. I put a handle on it and gave it to Ed because it's a 440.
What was the theory?
They thought it was going to feed back and add sustenance, and of course, it doesn't do that.
Yeah, it's 440. Huh?
Yeah, it's about an eighth beat or a 16th beat off. This one is right on the money, but anyway.
Is that sharp?
No, this is just a little on the flat side.
I see.
On the dull.
Shows you where my ear is
on the dull side.